Good morning, everyone. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. There's more good news on a COVID vaccine. This candidate is nearly 95% effective. And Australia's Rural Health Commissioner, Ruth Stewart, blasts the myth that services for mums and their babies in the bush aren't safe.
The reality is when you close rural maternity services, that's when mothers and babies are much more at risk of serious poor outcome and even death.
South Australians are waking up to life under COVID restrictions again as authorities work to rapidly suppress a cluster in Adelaide's northern suburbs. There's now a total of 20 actual and suspected cases in this outbreak, the first community transmissions in the state since April. But with thousands of people getting tested yesterday, there could well be more cases lurking. The state's Premier, Stephen Marshall, says the contact tracing system is working well, but vigilance is needed.
Put a lot of people, I'm talking hundreds and hundreds of people, into isolation, subjected them to a test, and at this stage just one new infection. But of course the incubation period is 14 days, so we remain very concerned about the Parafield cluster, and the advice is to go hard and go early, and that's precisely what we're going to be doing.
Yesterday the Premier swiftly closed gyms, recreation centres and play cafes temporarily and reintroduced caps on people at indoor venues. The snap rules meant some businesses only had hours to shut their doors. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
These girls are practicing gymnastics, running towards a vault and springing forward onto a pile of mats. Coach Tammy Page is watching over what will be the last class at Tea Tree Gully Gym Sports for at least a couple of weeks.
Who wants to show me what they're doing? Off you go.
The not-for-profit gymnastics centre in Banksia Park in Adelaide's northeastern suburbs shut its doors last night as part of a temporary closure of all gyms, recreation centres and play cafes in the state. Tammy Page is also the chair of the organisation's board.
I don't think you want to know what went through my head or what came out of my mouth.
Maybe not the exact words for radio purposes.
No. It's been a very long, hard day. When I did hear it, I was like, oh, now there's more. So we've immediately had to start, you know, notifying all the members. We have approximately 1,400 members that go through every week. Look at what birthday parties we've got for the next 2 weeks, cancel those, and then we've got to work out how to actually refund 2 weeks of term fees.
On the other side of the city, David Craggs runs a gym in the seaside suburb of Christie's Beach and says the temporary measures weren't entirely a surprise.
The one thing SA government have done is acted pretty aggressively and quickly in these situations, which I think is the right thing to do.
Although he appreciates the public health response, it creates uncertainty for his business.
We're an in-person, face-to-face service. In lockdown one, we did manage, my wife and I, Emma, managed to sort of convert the business to a Zoom model. We're confident we can do that again if need be.
Premier Stephen Marshall says the restrictions are likely to only be in place for a couple of weeks. Tammy Page says if it extends beyond that, it might not be worth her while to resume some classes before the end of the year.
Our kindergym program finishes before any other, so if it doesn't return in 2 weeks' time, that is their last week. Our general gym classes finish the following week. So it's also the impact on the kids. It'd be really playing with their mental status, I think, at the moment.
Along with the closure of gyms and recreation centres, South Australia has suspended international flight arrivals and temporarily reimposed a cap on patrons in hospitality venues at church gatherings and funerals. While weddings remain uncapped, guests must abide by social distancing rules.
Bridget Fitzgerald reporting there. For the second time this month, there's encouraging news about a COVID vaccine. Pharmaceutical giant Moderna's reporting its main vaccine candidate is close to 95% effective in trials. And if approved by authorities, it could be in mass production by the end of the year. But it won't be in time for the United States as it rides the swell of a second wave of COVID-19 infections. From Washington, Greg Jennett reports.
It's a really important milestone in the fight against the pandemic.
Moderna's president, Stephen Hoges, achieved a rare feat these days. He's the cautious bearer of good news.
It's really just a milestone, though. We have a lot of work ahead of us. Knowing the vaccine is going to be effective is great news, but we still need to complete the regulatory process.
After Pfizer, Moderna's the second company to report almost 95% effectiveness of its vaccine in trials. That means it works in blocking the virus, but it doesn't mean it's proven itself safe. Even so, applications for approval are pending. And if they come through,
we hope to have about 20 million doses of the vaccine by the end of this year.
So now we have two vaccines that are really quite effective.
Anthony Fauci's the most recognised authority on this disease. He has little doubt the vaccines will clear regulatory approval.
We project that by the end of December, that there will be doses of vaccines available for individuals in the higher risk category from both companies.
The goal is to reach every American, so logistics and distribution would at that point become as important as the lab work has been up to now. The Moderna product's useful because it'll survive in a standard fridge for a month, longer if it's put in the freezer compartment. The stock exchange likes the news. And for governments and public health officials, the prospect of mass vaccination can't come soon enough.
With a second wave bearing down on us, there's an opportunity to fight. There's an opportunity to beat this back.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's in a race against time. The city's not by any means among the worst performer for new cases. That mantle sits in parts of Texas and the upper Midwest. But the New York mayor's watching as the new infection rate edges towards 3%.
We see some areas where there's real concern.
3% is the automatic trigger he set months ago for shutting down some or all of the classrooms in America's biggest school education system, with more than a million students in it.
Thank God we're finally on the pathway to a vaccine and the bigger changes we need.
President-elect Joe Biden's approaching the task with the same level of determination. He's convened a video hookup with economic advisors to contemplate a rebuild of American business, industry and commerce, all of it predicated on the pandemic receding. In Washington, this is Greg Jennett reporting for AM.
Prime Minister is flying to Japan this morning for his first overseas visit since the COVID pandemic started. Defence, Japan's 2050 carbon neutral commitment and how Australian hydrogen could help with that program are all up for discussion. It's happening at a time when relations with China are at rock bottom. Regional instability is bringing Australia and Japan together with plans to strengthen economic and defence ties, yet it's not clear if a long-negotiated key military cooperation deal will be signed on this trip. Our North Asia correspondent Jake Sturmer reports from Tokyo.
To much fanfare over the last few months, several Australian ministers have been here in Tokyo, a major commitment in the middle of a pandemic. Now it's Prime Minister Scott Morrison's turn, and he'll be the first world leader to be hosted by Japan's new leader, Yoshihide Suga. Donna Weeks is a professor at Musashino University in Tokyo, where she teaches Japanese politics.
We had Foreign Minister Maurice Payne come and visit as part of the Quad talks. That was followed up very quickly with the Defence Minister Reynolds coming to visit. And so I think these are some significant steps in the relationship very early in Suga's new Prime Ministership.
Over the last few years, the defence relationship between Japan and Australia has only grown stronger with bilateral air combat exercises as well as naval exercises in the South China Sea. But a sticking point has been a document known as the Reciprocal Access Agreement, which sets out the legal and administrative framework for the Australian Defence Force to operate in and around Japan, and the same for Japan's Self-Defence Force in Australia. Talks on the deal have been stalled over the condition of Australian troops being subject to the death penalty in Japan. The Japan-US Status of Forces Agreement, a similar document implemented after World War II, has been a historical source of tension between the two close allies, according to Carnegie Endowment senior fellow James Schoaf.
Plenty of cases of crimes that were committed where suspects were not handed over within X number of days. In some cases, you know, never handed over. We'll take care of it. Don't you worry. Kind of thing, and real public political dissatisfaction in Japan with the way that is.
Despite the political sensitivities, the ABC understands there is broad agreement on the text, subject to any last-minute legal changes, but it may not be signed today. Negotiations for a travel bubble between Australia and Japan are being complicated with fears of a third wave of coronavirus cases in the country amid record numbers of infections over the last week. Irrespective of what comes out of this visit, the significance of an in-person trip shows just how important the relationship is to the Australian government in this time of great global uncertainty. This is Jake Sturmer in Tokyo, reporting for AM.
Experts are hoping there'll be a major revamp of Australia's mental health system, prompted by a newly released Productivity Commission report that's revealed major shortcomings. That lengthy review has found the cost of mental illness is more than $200 billion every year. Leaders in schools and workplaces are being urged to play a bigger role in ensuring people's mental health. Sarah Seggi reports.
The Productivity Commission report found that whether directly or indirectly, mental health issues affect every Australian. CEO of Beyond Blue, Georgie Harmon, hopes this is a moment of systemic change.
I hope it's a day that we look back on and say that was the moment that things started to properly be reformed.
The report found Australia's mental health system needs a bigger focus on prevention and early intervention.
Workplaces to schools to starting early in life to supporting parents to keeping people out of homelessness to ensuring that people have good work. These are the things, these areas of our lives that actually really contribute to good mental health. These are the places and spaces where we can catch people early.
Andrew Pierpoint is the president of the Australian Secondary Principals Association. He's also supportive of the Commission's recommendation that schools have a clearly defined role in supporting the social and emotional well-being of students.
The important part of that is the intervention when the intervention's required, but hopefully putting strategies in place to teach students about the triggers and the signs so that students can, you know, the utopia is that students can self-care, self-motivate and self-seek help.
The Commission would also like to see enhanced mental health support in the workplace. Dr. Andrew Ebringer is the Medical Director at International SOS, a health and security firm that provides services to many organisations.
And I think one of the solutions here, amongst many solutions, is to provide some training for line managers to be able to engage with their workforce. You're only going to learn about mental health problems amongst your workforce if you feel confident enough to ask those questions and have a plan to cope with the responses and how you're going to help your employees if they do say that they have mental health issues.
Associate Professor John Allen is the president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists. He's pleased to see a focus on empowering people to make the best health decisions for themselves.
Well, often people feel that they're controlled, that other people are making decisions for them. So what we really need to do is to make sure the person is at the centre of care. And every time we have an interaction, we need to think about, what does this person want? What does this person need? What are they hoping to get out of it? And how am I going to help them get that?
That's Associate Professor John Allen. He's the President of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists, ending Sarah Seggi's report. And if you or anyone you know need help, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Australia's Rural Health Commissioner is pleading with all governments to stop closing rural maternity services. Associate Professor Ruth Stewart warns the risk of premature babies rises when women don't have access to continuity of care. That's access to an own midwife from pregnancy to birth. In Indigenous communities, the incidence of premature births halves when that service is available. Professor Stewart is a rural generalist doctor based on Thursday Island, and she's making the case in Canberra today for reversing the trend of closing down facilities. Ruth Stewart, good morning and welcome to AM.
Thank you, Sabra.
How are you going to encourage governments to reopen rural maternity centres in rural and regional areas?
Well, I think the facts speak really strongly. At present, in rural and remote communities, pregnant women have nearly twice the risk of giving birth prematurely compared with their sisters in cities. 13.5% of remote women will have a premature birth, whereas in the cities that figure is 8%. So you look at that and then you start thinking and talking about what we know makes a difference. And we know that continuity of care, with midwifery group practice and continuity of care with GP obstetricians can halve the prematurity rate. That's been shown in Indigenous urban communities, and we've now seen it on Thursday Island, where we've introduced a midwifery group practice.
How would you describe the service that women get now in the bush? Do you think that they're second-class citizens compared with their sisters in the cities?
Look, I think it's about access to care. We have really strong evidence that where there is a rural maternity service, it provides good quality care. There's been an urban myth about rural maternity for a very long time that it's not safe. And that myth has driven the closure of a lot of rural maternity services. Between 1995 and 2005, over 130 rural maternity services closed. They used both safety arguments and they also used finance. It's too expensive to do this. But the reality is, when you close rural maternity services, that's when mothers and babies are much more at risk of serious poor outcome and even death.
At a time when governments now are scraping for every cent to pay for the cost of COVID restrictions and whatever else, how do you think this request is going to be met? How are you going to convince them that this is money that needs to be spent? These centres need to be kept open and more need opening.
It's about safety. There are an increasing number of rural babies born before arrival in the large hospitals where when their mothers are driving to the hospitals. And we know that if women have a local maternity service where there's continuity of care, they're less likely to have a premature birth. The babies are more likely to be born at a normal birth weight, and particularly for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, their baby can be born on country and within a culturally safe service. We know that the cultural safety of a maternity service is very important. Sometimes cultural safety is more important than physical safety for some women. That's a choice they make.
Your own sister Mary was very lucky to survive birth. It was a different era, admittedly, but she came after your mother had had three miscarriages before your sister was born, and she was the first baby taken by a humidity crib to a larger hospital. How much has your own family history sort of experienced you and what you want to achieve here?
Look, I think it really, I knew the importance of having a good healthcare team in the town from a very early age. And I just assumed that that was the safest way. And, you know, kids accept what they see. But I, got to university and looked and thought and challenged. And so for me, it was always important. It was always important that there be care close to home. And the urban assumption that rural people would want to travel to the big city because that's where care is best just never actually made sense to me.
Ruth Stewart, thank you for joining AM this morning.
Been my very great pleasure. Thank you, Sabra.
And Ruth Stewart is Australia's Rural Health Commissioner. Most of the water controversially taken from farmers in the Murray-Darling Basin and put into Commonwealth Environment water holdings hasn't been making its way to the floodplains and wetlands targeted by environmental water managers. Instead, it's been blocked, either physically or legally, by private land. And if those blockages aren't fixed soon, more water will be brought back from irrigators. National Science and Environment correspondent Michael Slezak reports.
Floods in parts of the Murray-Darling Basin are a part of life for farmers and essential for the wetland, forests, birds and fish that live there. Darren O'Halloran, a farmer from Balrenold in New South Wales near the border with Victoria, took it upon himself to pump water onto the wetlands on his property.
The floodplain actually has to be watered with environmental water with our irrigation pump. We just fill up the wetlands as best we can.
Professor Jamie Pittock is from the Australian National University.
To keep the wetlands on the floodplains healthy, the iconic places like the Billabongs and floodplain lakes, the water actually needs to fill up the river channels and spill out onto the land.
But between the wetlands that need watering and the rivers with the water in them are thousands of private properties. So without thousands of farmers doing what Darren O'Halloran is doing, or at least allowing government water managers to move water across their farms, the $13 billion Murray-Darling Basin plan is at risk. Professor Jamie Pittick's been looking at the issue.
Sadly, we've found that less than 2% of the area of wetlands that could be watered has been watered.
David Papps was the person responsible for that environmental water between 2012 and 2018.
The critical messages match up with my own experience as the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder. In very simple terms, rivers need to be connected from beginning to end, and importantly, there needs to be connection between the river and adjacent floodplains.
In 2014, the New South Wales and Victorian governments promised to fix that connectivity, to reach agreements with private landholders to allow their land to be inundated. In return, less water was bought from irrigators, the idea being that with the problem fixed, less water was needed to reach the intended environmental outcomes.
Sadly, the Victorian and New South Wales government simply haven't delivered so far.
If that's not done by 2024, more water will be needed to be bought from irrigators. Claire Miller is the CEO of New South Wales Irrigators Council.
You've just got to be realistic about how quickly these things can happen.
She wants the deadline extended and the threat of buybacks removed.
It's a blunt instrument that's perceived as a threat hanging over these communities. If you don't play ball in an outrageously and unrealistic timeframe, we will come and buy the water back from you instead.
Darren O'Halloran doesn't quite see what all the fuss is about.
I remember when I was a kid how the river system used to flood nearly every year. The yabbian and the fishing and the bird life, it was just in the natural environment. It was pretty much like the wetlands, up in the north.
He says if it takes more buybacks to get back to that, he's okay with it.
The water was there for the environment, so it still should be there for the environment.
That's farmer Darren O'Halloran ending Michael Slezak's report. Governors of the Reserve Bank are usually very cautious and conservative, so this latest advice from the current governor might seem a bit surprising. Philip Lowe says consumers and businesses should start taking some risks, despite the economic fallout from the pandemic. Mr. Lowe's message to investors comes amid some optimism about two potential COVID vaccines. Our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, joined me earlier. Peter, good morning. Interest rates are near zero and the RBA is buying $100 billion of government debt because of the depth of the crisis. So why is Philip Lowe telling consumers and businesses to take on more risk?
Well, good morning, Sabra. Those emergency measures show how bad things are. But speaking in Sydney last night, Philip Lowe said 2020 had been a sobering year and it'll be talked about for decades. But he says the focus now has to be almost entirely on creating jobs, getting the unemployment rate down and building confidence. Mr. Lowe says if the vaccines are effective, Australia's economy will rebound next year. But for that, he says consumers need to start spending and business needs to invest to get people back into work. Mr. Lowe says that despite the uncertainties and so many unknowns out there, the economic recovery depends on risk takers, but that small players, in addition to the big ones, getting almost no return on bank deposits, they need to be careful as well.
If businesses are to seize the opportunities that are out there, some degree of risk taking is necessary. So we do need to guard against becoming too risk averse. Another area that we're watching carefully is how people adjust their portfolios as they search for yield in a low interest rate world. Some people will no doubt move out along the risk spectrum. And as they do that, the additional investment risk will need to be understood and managed. It's important we do that well.
That's the Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe. Peter, away from the pandemic, the stock exchange was offline for most of yesterday. Will it be back online today?
Well, it was certainly a crisis yesterday for the Australian Securities Exchange, which operates the stock exchange. But a spokesman tells me this morning that it will be business as usual this morning when trade opens. Of course, this was an embarrassing technical glitch where the stock exchange shut down half an hour into trade yesterday. So no buying or selling. And normally around $5 billion in shares are traded every day. And this glitch occurred as part of a system changeover. And despite despite a number of dress rehearsals over a year, the Australian Securities Exchange was scrambling overnight to get trade running again for this morning. But now the corporate regulator, which has oversight over the stock exchange, has asked for a please explain, raising concerns about the integrity of the systems and that the outage is a significant concern.
It's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.